Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Well, good morning, good evening, good afternoon, wherever you are in the world, whatever time it is time for Spin the Rally Pod. You will have noticed that we are missing Lisa. Once again, Lisa, our illustrious leader, is in Beijing. Sorry, I should introduce myself. I'm David Evans. I am the staff writer at dirtfish.com. With me today on the podcast is George Donaldson, former sporting director, former team manager, former everything in the sport, and of course, former driver. We should never forget that, George. Something that I think we always play down, George. We'll get to that in a second. Deputy editor, Luke. Deputy editor Luke Barry, is this your debut on the pod, Luke?
This is. I feel like a bit of a not so super sub coming off the bench in the absence of Colin as well.
Yes, yeah, you will have noticed that we're down to just a one Scott, but of course we're not, because we've lost one Scott in Colin Clark, who's off in Australia, and we have gained Luke Barry, who is another Scott. We are all about the Scots, which is disappointing for an Englishman. 2 days after we failed to win the Calcutta Cup.
Indeed. But however, David, I mean, it must be noted that our normal Skype call didn't work and we had to dial in sort of slightly separately. So even without Colin, all these technical issues have nothing to do with you. They're quite clearly to do with someone else. I'm part of that. It's scary.
Yeah. When we were struggling with Skype this morning, I was on the phone to Luke and I'd encourage Luke over the weekend that everything would be fine. It would be no problem.
Yes.
And it was something of a concern. But anyway, we're here. We have made it. So welcome, Luke and George. So what are we going to talk about? The thing that I would like to talk about first is the testing that we've seen last week. Obviously, we're now done with Monte Carlo. That is a distant memory. And we are rapidly moving towards round two in Rally Sweden, which is why we saw... Last week we saw both in Finland, Toyota and Hyundai testing. So I have a question for you both. Can either of you tell me how and why Hyundai was testing in Finland?
No, I can't tell you, but I'm desperate to know, David. Just don't keep me in suspense. This is not a quiz show. Come on.
It's not. So I had a good chat with Julien Monset on Friday afternoon. I couldn't figure it out either. It didn't seem to make sense that, okay, they can go and test anywhere. You know, the testing regulations mean you can test anywhere in Europe. You just can't test outside of Europe. But I couldn't really fathom why Hyundai had gone to what I think was sort of central Finland instead of going up north to northern Sweden, where Umeå, where round two will be. So I spoke to Julien Monset, and he explained, this is one that's caught us both out, and Luke as well, that there is now a secondary testing base for apparently it's known as the systems check base. It's a second permanent test site that the teams are now permitted. I guess this is a rally one new regulation thing. So each team can now nominate a second test site. So Hyundai has nominated central Finland close to Jyväskylä, where it can now go and test as much as it wants.
In your face, Toyota.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
This is the point. And I put that point to Julien Monset and said, you know, isn't it a strange place to go? And he said, well, essentially, if you can't beat them, join them, which of course they hope that by joining them, they will beat them. So that's it. So we know that M Sport's second permanent test base will be its own test track at Dovenby. So they've kind of got both bases covered really quite nicely. They've got some good tarmac, and they've got Greystoke as their primary test site as well. So that is why we saw all of the hind eyes testing in Finland. And George, one question to you. As you move from Monty into Sweden with a brand new car, what sort of stuff, I mean, what are you focusing on in testing? What are they looking for? What are they working on?
Well, if you're talking directly about Hyundai, which I presume we are.
Generally, as these cars move out of Monty.
Well, you're going to one of the fastest rallies in the world. Now, fast rallies for me are, there's two key places to test. One are the very high speed events, like Finland, like Sweden. Not dissimilar at all. Quite dissimilar car setup in one way, but in another way, very, very similar. Super high speed. Sweden was always the fastest rally in the world for many, many years. Despite what everyone thinks, it being snow and slippery, you're on these lovely spiked tires and the speed is enormous. And I believe that up in Umeå, we're going to be even quicker than we have been in the past. If it's lost its mantle as the fastest rally in the world, it's about to regain it. So, yeah. When you go to these rallies to test, sorry, David, it is all about balance and confidence and extracting that speed, being able to lean on the car, making sure the car doesn't twitch around, it doesn't tend to edge out too sideways, doesn't tend to drift into understeer. Now, that's a difficult shout with these cars now because we're locked four-wheel drive again, so it's quite a difficult dynamic balance. I don't really understand the kinematics of it, and I never have pretended to. We've got lovely engineers that do that for us in when you're in teams. So it's a tricky balance to strike, but when you get your car right on these super high speed rallies, it will go quickly. You'll then rebalance. It's the question of setup to get it right everywhere else. The other place you used to go and test was in rough places. Everyone used to go down to Châtelet-Stour or Acropolis, or if you had the facility, even Kenya, and that finds where your car breaks. That was the key there. So speed and toughness, that's the two big tests. So Sweden test, massive. Everyone's got to be looking for that lovely stable car that just can feed in with confidence. And it's, you go sideways for so long on this rally and quite severely, because you can lean the car on the snowbanks, and I know it sounds like a strange thing, but relatively easy to understand. We can all understand the effect of a rudder, and that's what the car is doing. The back wheels, or even the side bodywork at times, is pushing into the snow, and you can lean the car, and it makes sense. What really is difficult to understand, but wonderful to drive and wonderful to experience, is when you come into a corner too quickly and you stick the nose of the car into the snow, and it drags the nose into the snow. And if the road's narrow enough, the back end will hit the outside, or just the sheer traction of the car, or you can pull the nose out. You've got the car turned in and it will hold the car, drag the car around the corner on the inside. So it's quite an interesting set of dynamics, all about balance and confidence, David, here.
So just explain that a bit more, George. So you stick the nose of the car. So if you're going into a left-hander, you're sticking the front left corner of the car into the inside snowbank.
Yeah, you absolutely are, David. And you watch a few videos, you'll see it happening. Generally speaking, on the sort of medium to slower corners where you're coming in at very, very high speed, and it really, really works. I've utilized the technique myself. Relatively recently, the last time I drove a car on snow in any sort of anger was, I don't know, maybe 2007 or 2008. I drove a zero car on the Tommy Mäkinen rally in Jyväskylä, where we ran about four or five classic Thousand Lakes stages in the snow.
Wow.
And I was made zero car. I was terrified. So I've got the competition cars running 5 minutes behind me. They were big stages. You know, they were big 15, 20 kilometer stages. I'm thinking, crikey, I've got these guys right behind me and I've got to not go off. I had no pace notes. Nobody had pace notes, but you can imagine all the locals knew the stages by heart. I'd said to Tommy, I said, can we not get me made into a triple zero car rather than a zero car? No. This was the Tommy Mäkinen. It was a Subaru. It was all done up in Tommy Mäkinen colors. And I had to do zero car, and that was it. And this went on for a couple of days, this joking and jostling about this. whilst I was out there in Finland. I even spoke to the clerk of the course, and he said, no, George, you'll be fine. Nobody's going to catch you. We know you. And I'm thinking, well, that's really nice, you know, but I think these guys are overestimating me. I've done the Swedish rally six times, so I know how to drive on snow. And
you've just stolen my thunder there, George. I was just about to say, talking to a six-time Swedish rally competitor. And I think actually what we'll do, George, is that as we close in on the Swedish, perhaps next week, the week after, we'll do a podcast simply dedicated to your six Swedish rallies.
Oh, my God.
When you've done... Luke, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but George has done the Swedish in cars as varied as a Mini, all the way up to a four-wheel drive Sierra, which was, of course, the 2.8. Non-turbo.
No. I did it in the two-wheel drive turbo, David.
Oh, did you?
It was the Group N two-wheel drive turbo. I did it in.
But our friends at EWRC here have you down in 1988 in an XR 4x4.
They've got it wrong. It was a two-wheel drive car. And we just up to a point. We finally slipped off the road near the end of the rally. However, I was telling you about there was a long usual George Donaldson problem of telling you about how to tuck into a corner using the inside of the corner. I was telling you about the story in Finland. So just to finish that one up, basically they all insisted that I'd be fine at zero car. Turned up in the morning, pitched up towards the first stage to discover that the car is the event is reverse seeding. And I've got a Hillman imp following me, so they were quite confident that nobody was going to catch me. Perhaps I had 2 or 3 days sweating it, and they were laughing like hell when I discovered. It was really, really very funny.
But it was absolutely. So yeah. But yeah, so we have seen a busy couple of weeks, or a busy last week from the teams testing. M Sport start their Swedish testing on the 14th of February there up in Cal. I would imagine the Cal Auto Lodge, which actually they may not be at the Cal Auto Lodge, because I think Cal Auto Lodge is, I'm going to Google it right now. I think
I don't know about this Cal Auto Lodge, David. I'm not sure. Where's that?
It's up. Well, it's in Cal. And it is, it's the place that everybody used to go to for testing, right in the very, very, very far north. It's near Ore.
Okay.
And we went up there with Richard Tutter. We did some Porsche driving on ice up there.
Nice.
But it was, I'm sure it was Kenneth Erickson that owned the Cal Auto Lodge.
That rings a bell now. That rings a bell. I remember. Yeah. Or was it his co-driver? Was it Stefan Parman?
Yeah, that exactly. Yes, it was. And it was a really super cool place. And we, without actually wanting to name drop, myself and Anthony Peacock went up with Tutty to drive his Porsches at the same time that the Sainz family were there doing some driving with Richard. So we got the incredible opportunity to race and drive against Carlos and Carlos Jr. And it was a one and only chance I actually got to ride in a car with Carlitos. So Ferrari's current F1 driver took me around the stage in a 911. And I have to say that if you think you've got a sort of rivalry with your father, you've got nothing on the two Carlos's. Although actually segueing quite nicely into father and son rivalry, who watched Race of Champions at the weekend?
And listen, I did not.
Did you catch any, Luke?
I caught most of the sort of, I forget, I mean, someone's going to slaughter me for this, but I forget what the competition between all the drivers is called. I didn't see the Nations Cup on Saturday, but I saw
Champion of Champions.
That's the one. Thank you, David. You bailed me out.
it's not complicated. It just say this word champion twice in the same sentence. Champion of Champions. Yeah, that was, I have to say, I've had a sort of, not by no means a love-hate relationship with the Race of Champions in the past, but I've kind of loved some of them and then not really enjoyed some of them. But this one, my goodness me, I absolutely
loved it. Was it good, David?
Oh,
fantastic.
It was brilliant. And not least because poor Frederick Johnson and his team, it was all on the, we keep saying the Baltic Sea. George, if you go right up north in Sweden to the bit where it's kind of in a big bay between Sweden and Finland, what's that bit called?
That's the Baltic.
Oh, is it? Okay, so it was the Baltic Sea.
I'll just check on the map as we speak, but basically that's the Baltic that you enter. I'm not aware that there's any other part of that sea called anything else, but I'll be able to tell you in about 10 seconds.
So that bit...
Gulf of Bothnia.
A Gulf of Bothnia. There we are.
Gulf of Bothnia, there you are.
The Umea Bay, not the Umea Bay, what was it called? It's Pitti Havsbad. So right up north, and the whole sea was frozen, completely frozen. Sea temperature of -2, apparently, which is very frozen. And they set the stage up, the circuit and everything, on the frozen sea. And the night before, so Friday night, the night before the Nations Cup, apparently there was quite a high tide, and the sea somehow managed to sort of wash over the top of the ice and flood the circuit. Which would be quite disconcerting as you're about to go out on your opening lap and driving through 30 centimetres of seawater. But a massive effort from the team. They got it all cleared. They found themselves a circuit. And it was a great 2 days of competition. Lovely blue skies on Saturday and terrible cloudy snow on Sunday. But a victory for the Solbergs and Team Norway. On Saturday, and then the most epic day of racing on Sunday, with Sebastian Vettel fighting Sebastian Loeb for victory in the final. And tell us, Luke, you pick it up now. Tell us who won.
I don't think we need to ask that question these days, do we? It feels like it's about 2005 again. He's winning everything. He can't be soft. It's mental. Absolutely mental.
He did look absolutely back to his best again, didn't he, there?
Yeah.
Traditionally, it was always rally drivers tended to get the better on the race of champions because it is kind of more like rallying than racing, even when it's on asphalt. But yeah. I'm very happy to hear that Mr. Loeb did it again. That was tremendous.
But sorry, Luke. No, carry on.
I was just going to say, I think the obvious caveat with the contest on Sunday was Vettel is a Formula One champion and Loeb is the master of all things off-road, really. You kind of did expect Loeb to win, but A, his results were and his speed was impressive, but secondly, it wasn't like Vettel is not a good driver, and it's not as if he wasn't learning the track and everything. There were clearly quite a few drivers that were up for this because both Loeb and Vettel, I think, on the same run made some quite key mistakes, smashing into snowbanks and everything else. So it always amazes me, even though this is essentially just a pre-season bit of fun, just how seriously they all take it. And I love that. It's brilliant.
Yeah, definitely. No, you could absolutely see that. And, you know, one of the best moments for me was when, so on his way to the quarterfinal, Loeb beat Petter Solberg. So Sebastian went through to the quarterfinal. In the quarterfinal, he faced Oliver Solberg. So if Petter had beaten Sebastian, it would have been a quarterfinal with Oliver versus Petter, but it wasn't. It was Oliver versus Sebastian. And by his own admission, Oliver wasn't great. And they used some Porsche, I think they were Cayman GT4s or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Oliver wasn't great. He didn't realise quite how much grip there was and dropped a couple of seconds to Loeb there. And then they were in these, well, they were RX2 lights, weren't they? The electric lights cars.
There was the older RX2 light car and there was an RX2E, which is essentially the same thing, but with batteries, not the internal combustion engine.
So they were in the battery things for their second race. and they finished absolutely dead level. Oliver Solberg and Sebastian Loeb to the thousandth of a second.
Wow.
They couldn't be split. Apparently the first time this has happened in Race of Champions history, but it was just so cool to see, you know, what is probably the future of the World Rally Championship with an absolute, I was going to say past master, but he's not. He's a current
master. Championship leader, David. Come on.
Yeah. Well, no, exactly. This is a good point, Luke, is in, you know, everything that we're writing at the moment, we're talking about the fact that Kalle Rovanperä will obviously be first on the road in Sweden. And it's your immediate assumption is, championship leader Kalle Rovanperä. He's not. Absolutely not. We're led by two Sebs at the moment. Race of Champs, fantastic. Congratulations to everybody involved. The absolute highlight for me was not actually the competition. It was there was a demonstration between the FC1X, which is quite possibly the most extraordinary electric race car. It's the car that we're going to be seeing in Nitro RX this year. Developed by Olsbergs, is it, Luke?
Yeah.
So we're talking sort of 1,100 horsepower in probably a 1,200 kilogram car. So an awesome bit of kit. So there was that in one lane, and Stig Blomqvist in an Audi Quattro E2 in the other lane with brilliant. Just, it was the most fantastic moment. You know, you got this absolute silence on one side and that beautiful five-cylinder rumble on the other.
Oh, tremendous.
I think they were supposed to do two laps, and they must have done about 10 or something in the end. And it was
really,
it was just quality. And they'd got, you know, it was really misty and snowing a bit. And I remember on the E2, they always had that sort of triangle of spotlights. So they had six spots, but it was two underneath, one above.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
So they're running in that setup. It was just
so the E2 was still the long Quattro, wasn't it?
The E2, there's always sort of debate about this. Is it an S1 and an S2? The E2 was the one with the big wings.
Oh, right. So that was the last one. That was the last one, right? Okay. Yeah. Sorry, I was thinking it was just the second one.
Well, I always used to get this wrong, and then our cherished friend David Williams, the world's greatest journalist, took me to one side one day, and I think he probably even showed me the homologation papers from Audi, and said, "There you are. It's homologated as a Quattro E2," and from that moment, I never forgot that it was always the E2. It's the E2, and. And once again, that's actually quite a nice segue, talking about David Williams, DKW to many of us. One of his really quite good friends, I think, in the sport, was Tony Pond, of course. David and Pondy were quite similar, actually, in kind of character. They were both very private people, both absolutely lived for the sport. And of course, we've lost them both. But it was, I tell you what, Luke, you take up this story, because this is your story. You've written the fabulous feature that is on dirtfish.com today.
I do like the fact you called it fabulous, David, because I know for a fact you haven't read it yet.
I'll take that. Expecting it to be fabulous. Of course it'll be fabulous. It's written by you.
Well, I've no idea what to say to that. But today, as we record, yesterday when you hear this, if you listen to the day it's come out, it is 20 years since he lost Pondy. And to be fair, for me, it became a bit of a passion project almost to look this up, because I think for my generation, born in the mid to late 90s, obviously as a British rallying fan, we were spoiled. We had Colin, we had Richard, and you were kind of, it's a shame in a way, you always chose one side. You sort of liked them both, but you always had a preference. But before that, it's easy to forget just how long Britain had waited for a rallying star. And in terms of driving and talent and everything else, Tony should really have been that guy. Of course, he did have some great results. I think we all look back on the 85 RAC, for example, as one of his best drives. Mm-hmm. There, of course, are plenty of others. I think the couple of EPRA wins in the Triumph were equally spectacular, but in terms of world championship success, I don't think he ever really peaked beyond the 85 RAC. I mean, George, you consider how much else he achieved in the car and how good he was. It's quite astonishing the way that that's sort of all he achieved in WRC.
It is. I mean, his refusal to drive a left-hand car, I think, was his undoing. But maybe he realised that it was too hard for him to adapt, or maybe he just didn't. He couldn't be bothered. Which, if you knew Tony Pond, He was such a character and such a, I don't know, he wasn't, I wouldn't necessarily call him a gentleman, I didn't know him that well, but he was a fabulously fun bloke who just kind of did his own thing. I mean, fantastic little cameo memories of him doing the Ypres rally. And I mean, you say he only won it a couple of times. I would have said, if you'd asked me just straight off, I'd have said Tony Pond had won that at least four or five times. He was sublime on that incredibly difficult event, albeit in good machinery, but he went in a variety of machinery and showed his supremacy on a number of occasions. I remember him doing Corsica just in a Nissan 240 RS, where, you know, honestly, he should have just been getting an absolute gubbing. And he showed really, really well. He definitely punched well above his weight on that one with that car. But yes, I suppose his British events were the way. But let's not forget. I mean, you go back into the early 80s, the late 70s and the early 80s. The early 80s, he was driving a Chevette HSR, mm-hmm. a car well at the end of its development. And he was taking on Jimmy McRae and Henry Toivonen on a Scottish rally, the first international rally I did, the Scottish rally. Pentti Arikola, Henry Toivonen, Jimmy McRae, Russell Brooks, they were all the drivers of the time. And he was beating them with an old Chevette HSR with hardly any suspension travel by comparison to the Ascona 400s, the last of the Escorts, Talbot Sunbeam Lotuses. All superior cars, and he absolutely walked away with it. The guy was a magician, an absolute artist as a driver.
It's a strange one, isn't it? That his, you know, I grew up appreciating Pondy as much as anybody, but he never won a British Championship, did he?
I'm not sure. No, he didn't.
No, he didn't. But this is the strange thing, isn't it? It's kind of what I was sort of trying to alluded to before. It's he was that good, but he never won the things that everybody sort of thought he would or should do. And I think that's why, I think particularly, and I could be speaking out of turn here, but from the sort of vague research I've done, and I'm using this as my brother as a bouncing board, and so not sure if it's the biggest sort of set example in the world, but he said to me, "Who's Tony Pond?" And that for me is exactly what's a shame is of people of my generation, you don't remember him because you don't see his name on the Roll of Honour and think, oh, well, we'll learn about this guy. Mm. If you know your stuff, you watch the videos, you see them. And I work plenty with this. I'd always been vaguely aware of what he was like. But writing this feature and speaking to the people that knew him best, you really do just realise just how special he was. It was almost like a, and I don't want to say simple because that makes it sound like he wasn't very good, but it was just, there was no sides to Tony. He just got in the car and he drove it. There was no politics or anything else. He just did his job. And as you say, John, you mentioned it, the drives on course car, I think, and someone can correct me here, but I'm pretty sure, I think it was 81, he was third. That ended up being only one of his two podiums in the World Championship, which is mental.
Yeah, it is. It is, and it's, and also what is also a real shame is that we talked a lot about 85 RAC. Of course, he was co-driven then by Rob Arthur, who also sadly isn't with us. Because you know, I, the very start of my career, I worked a little bit with Rob when he was running a Ford One Make Championship in Britain, and the stories from that guy were just phenomenal. And it would have been a real treat to have had Rob on the podcast with us talking and just remembering some of those great stories. One man who probably could remember, and I'm sure will remember, is the co-driver from that Corsica in 81 was Ian Grindrod. And I thought for a long time, we do need to get Ian Grindrod on the podcast. So if you're listening, Ian, which I'm not sure if you do.
He certainly reads our Dirtfish stuff, and I'm pretty sure Ian listens.
Yeah, you'll be getting the call very, very soon. And I've got to say once again, and I'll put this one on the pod right now, Ian and John Meadows out there, I am very sorry that I still haven't written the John Meadows feature, which I really should have done, which actually goes all the way back to Safari last year. Because Ian rang me and said, don't forget John Meadows when you're talking about safaris and Africa and co-drivers. And of course, we do forget, don't we? Or I did forget, George, that John Meadows is he won Ivory Coast and one of Britain's best co-drivers. And
that's right, yes.
Least talked about. So, Ian, you'll be on the pod, and John, your words will be on Dirtfish soon. So just back to the 85 RAC. That, for me, was just the most fantastic memory to see that car, the 6R4, making its debut in WRC. And it could have won that round. You know, Pondy could have won that event, couldn't he? So,
obviously, I'm not sure, actually. I mean, I was there. I was working on that rally. That was my first RAC rally with Toyota.
Was it
at that point? So we were donning our two-wheel drive cars at that point, our old Group B Celicas, obviously. I was pretty focused in on my
George, it's partly your fault then.
Juha Kankkonen pulled
exactly
Marco Alén out of a ditch. That's right. And he went on to finish second. Yes,
exactly.
So you have got a lot of trouble for that from Uwe.
Well, in fairness, George, I'm surprised in your first event as in any role, in any capacity as Toyota, I'm surprised that you didn't step up and say, no, look, we're not having this. This is not acceptable. So what would you have been doing on that RAC in 85?
I did a variety of things. I did emergency tire service on a couple of occasions. I went running around with another Finnish mechanic, Jorma Alalati. He still works up in Jyväskylä making gearboxes and engines for all manner of vehicles, classics and current. The guy's an absolute mechanical genius. But we flew around the countryside. He drove and I navigated, and I remember he was utterly gobsmacked driving around North Wales. I was down on the maps trying to get us past all the traffic to get us into the little partially legal services that you were allowed to do.
You just have a bunch of tires in the back.
I think we had four tires in the back of a Toyota, four-wheel drive Toyota Tercel, which was really a two-wheel drive car that you could lock into four-wheel drive, but it could get you out of any sort of trouble if you'd got into a ditch or anything. It was a brilliant car. And we did that for about a day and a half. And then the other part of the time I was driving the motorhome with the two girls that did the catering for the motorhome. The motorhome was a big deal in those days. Only the really big teams had a motorhome, you know, it's huge. Everyone else just worked out the back of an estate car, even the factory teams. Pre-event, I did weeks of map marking, because all the service crews, all the rally crews, all had a full set of ordnance survey maps marked up with the route.
Yeah.
With all the passages, all the passage controls, time controls, stages, service points, all marked on them, every single one. So you can imagine that we rented a hotel function room, which would have been huge. You know, it would have seated 50 or 60 people, and we had tables set around it. There would be five or six of us, usually including all the co-drivers, and we sat around and we marked maps.
Wow.
And that's what we did.
And you would have, in those days, you would have been finding exactly where to service after every stage, and that was all done.
That was done on a pre-event recce. So the team manager, that would have been Uwe Andersson, had gone around. Henry Lydon would have gone around the route and done the recce. Popped into all the farms. We had all. You even put the phone numbers on the map. You even wrote down the farmer's name and the phone number. Leave a jacket, you know. Make sure the driver says hello to the guy's wife. You know, you didn't mark that on the map, but you certainly have there was instructions in the service plan for all that sort of stuff.
And you had Juha, and it would have been Bjorn.
Juha, Bjorn, and who was the third driver? Sure, did we have a third driver?
I cannot remember.
Per was still driving for Toyota on and off at that point. I can't remember if we had a third driver or not.
But I mean, known as a whistling pig, wasn't it? That car.
Yes, it was. It was a lovely car. Dead easy to drive in many ways. But
was it?
You know, in RAC trim, that car would have had 380, 390 horsepower at the rear wheels. Massive amount of power for just a two-wheel drive, rear-wheel drive car at that time. And it was super fast, very highly geared. So where it used to make up time. And that car won a New Zealand rally against all the four-wheel drive cars.
Just because of its top-end speed and its balance.
It was the year that, what year was it? Must have been, was it 83 or 84 in New Zealand rally? Bjorn won it. And the rally went to the South Island, and the stages were very, very fast.
Yeah,
and Bjorn won. I mean, how do you win New Zealand in a two-wheel drive car against Peugeot T16s and Audi Quattros? Well, Bjorn did. So
he was that special, though, wasn't he?
But he was that special. Yeah.
That kind of car, somewhere like Yorkshire, where it into those really quick long straights. But no, it wasn't. Well, it was a special result, and so it's entirely George's fault that Pondy didn't finish second.
Entirely my team's fault. Juha Kankkonen, thank you, Juha, for the trouble you're now causing me once again.
and talking of, there was obviously a lot of snow, proper winter RAC that one. And moving into more winter rally chat, we do have Snowdrift coming up this week. Luke, is it this weekend?
Next weekend, I think. Yeah.
Okay. So we're a week out for the preview. This is very bad planning. Apologies, Lisa. Please don't put me in detention for this. But just from 2 weeks out then, or however far out we are, Luke, can you give us any insight into what's coming in Snowdrift?
I can do my best, David.
Sorry, I kind of put you on the spot.
it's not a rally I've been lucky enough to have gone to. But everything I've heard, and for absolute clarity as well, because we haven't mentioned it, is the opening round of the American Rally Association Championship. And I think what makes this one unique, guys, obviously, is the fact they compete on snow, but without studded tyres, which is
It's been like that for years. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's quite a different skill. to try and master.
Have you ever been out there, George, for that event?
No, I've not. But I've the modern tire without studs, the modern snow tire without studs, is very, very good, unbelievably good. Nothing like as good as a stud, but the competition studs, but actually remarkably good. But that rally has, I think, since forever, or since forever they've been doing those snow rallies, they don't allow the studded tyres. So it's a different beast altogether. All about finesse. I mean, such a skillful rally to drive, such a knife edge, albeit at slightly lower velocities, you'd have to say. And you could, you know, a little bit too quick on one corner, you'd be having your, it'd be a bit like Finland, you'd have your accident about six corners later because you can't slow down over the next six corners because you just don't have the traction. And you just know, hang on, there's a hairpin over a bridge and I've just got around, oh, crap. And you've got a quarter of a mile for these poor drivers to think about it, slapping off the snowbanks using the very best technique I was just about to explain earlier, which I failed to do, where you drop the nose of the car into the corner to try and pick it round. And it's such a balancing act to just put the nose in. It really, really does work. It drags the car in. So you've got to lift it back out again quickly. You don't have a big window to do it. It's a bit like trying to drive a Porsche sideways. It's a very narrow window to keep it right. All respect to those guys going out to do that rally and competition. They're going to have a fabulous time, but how challenging is that? Love to be there with them.
I have to say, it is. It's one of the events I've always hankered after going to. So it does. It sounds so special. And we had a meeting last week about it with some of the guys that are working with us out in America, Mason Runkle and these kind of guys. And we were talking about, you know, what do we talk about during the event and what will be the stories. And there's one place apparently called Bonfire Alley, which
it's
just
magic.
Do you know much? Explain it, Luke, because I heard a little bit about it last week, but you know more about it than me.
I think anyone who's ever seen pictures from Snowdrift, you'll either have seen stuff in the daylight going over jumps, the usual sort of action shots, or you'll have seen something in the dark with lots of lights and bonfires and everything else. It's just this magnificent stretch of spectating, I guess, where they all turn up. And I think in that call, actually, David, you sort of likened it a little bit to Collins Crest in Sweden. You've got everyone amalgamates to this one spot. And it's one of these things, we all talk about some of the greatest places in the world to spectate. You think of El Condor with the atmosphere up there in Argentina, probably anywhere on Rally Finland. But with this event, is they all come to the same bit. It's dark. They've got the flares out. They're lighting bonfires and they're literally shooting gas on the flames to make them look more spectacular. The cars they buy, only in America. But it's fantastic. I honestly, I hate to think what it's like to drive through there, because that, as George said, when you're essentially the rally equivalent of driving a shopping trolley without one of the working wheels, to then come through there with all this atmosphere. If it was me, I'd get lost in it. That's why I don't compete. I don't have the concentration for that. But it is fantastic. It's one of those sort of anything that should be on a rally fan's bucket list to go and see is that particular part of Snowdrift.
Yeah, No, it sounds fantastic. But don't get too excited. I'm a week early. That is, I'm just looking on dirtfish.com. Snowdrift Rally, 18th and 19th.
That event is 2 weeks away. I can still go. If somebody just sends me a ticket, I'll be there. I'm going to go to Bonfire Alley. Luke, I'm going to be there.
Yeah,
you're going to be with me. Let's go. Let's get out there.
I'll come as part of your carry-on luggage. I'm not small.
Fantastic. Yeah. There's plenty of carry-on luggage in first class. Don't worry. We'll get you on there.
Definitely. Well, I think that is about a wrap. We will do a more in-depth Snowdrift preview next week. That's a bit of warning for you, Luke. Luke will be with us again next week because I believe the esteemed Mr. Clark is still away, and Lise will still be watching and commentating brilliantly on ice hockey and artificial snow in Beijing. So well, thank you very much, Luke. That's been a fabulous debut on the podcast. Much appreciated.
I hope it wasn't too terrible.
No, absolutely not. No, genius. Still too many Scots on the pod for me, particularly the Monday after losing the count.
What was the score on Saturday?
I can't remember.
You're now talking about rugby. It's totally irrelevant. This is a rally podcast. And David, there's no such thing as Scots, English, French, Finnish, Swedish in rallying. You're rally, and that's it. Yes. It is not a religion. It is a religion. I was going to say it's not a religion. It is a religion. Is. A rally for everyone that's listening here, and for so many people that are not, that should be. We're not a religion. We are actually a nationality. I swear to goodness, it's just such a fantastic sport. And one day, David, I'll tell you about. Well, when we do the Swedish retrospect of my terrible efforts there, actually some of them were quite spectacular, at least I'll tell you about how to hook round a corner on the inside. I'll try and describe it in a bit more detail, which I completely failed to do today.
You could even draw us some pictures and we'll put those on social to demonstrate it, George.
I don't give away that stuff for free, David. It costs a fortune.
That's true.
Very happy to do it, but you know, sorry.
It'll cost
and us. I say costs a fortune. You know, I'm cheap. Lunch, dinner, a first-class flight to the Snowdrift Rally, whatever, it's all available.
It would be an absolute pleasure. Right, and it has been an absolute pleasure. So thank you very much, Jack, and same time next week.
Brilliant. Thank you, David. Thank you, David.